Sunny and 85. The new numbers are in. 72 degrees we're seeing in Kenosha. 62 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be replaying an interview out of the archives today, which takes us to one of the most beautiful places on Earth. I am so excited about this opportunity to explore the remarkable beauty and complex history of the Hawaiian Islands. And we're going to do so with an award-winning author by the name of Julia Flynn Seiler. She is a very, very highly regarded journalist whose work has appeared in Business Week, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and her previous book, The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty, was a bestseller. And if it's not already the case, I'm sure it will be soon. That is, I'm sure this next book is destined to be a bestseller as well. It certainly deserves to be. It's called Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, the Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. It tells the story, which is sometimes exciting, sometimes tragic and disheartening, of how the beautiful Hawaiian Islands, which existed in beautiful, serene isolation for such a long time, eventually, of course, became sought after as sort of a isolated sort of crown jewel in the midst of the Pacific Ocean, desired by a number of forces from the West, primarily the United States and Britain. And, of course, we all know where this story ultimately ends. But the story of how Hawaii ultimately became the 50th state of these United States is a complex checkered story, which the author explores in very, very interesting, well-researched detail. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Julia Flynn Seiler about her book, again called Lost Kingdom. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Julia Flynn Seiler, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Greg.
I wonder, ahead of undertaking this project, how much did you know about Hawaii and about its history?
Well, I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, Greg, but I didn't know very much. I'm a native Californian, and in my textbooks when I was growing up, I don't think there was anything that explained how Hawaii became the 50th state. And once I heard the story, I was fascinated by it and thought that it was really a story of American history that I thought more people should know.
Hmm. I suspect that you also had some notion that this was going to be a rich, complicated story that would give you no shortage of things to explore, but I'm guessing that you had no full way of knowing just how much you were going to be able to unearth. I mean, and just how rich and interesting this story, in fact, would be for you.
Well, you're right. I love stories about families and fortunes. My first book, The House of Mondavi, was about four generations of a Napa Valley wine family and their, you know, the rise and fall of their business empire. And I found a 19th century equivalent, in a sense, of the Mondavis, who were based in San Francisco, and they were called the Spreckles family. And the patriarch of that family, Claus Spreckels, was had the nickname the Sugar King. And likewise, on the other side, 2,500 miles off the shores of San Francisco, there was another family, and that family was the royal family of Hawaii, the last dynasty. And it was really interesting to trace the way these two families, their lives intersected and collided. And really, you could tell the story of the rise and fall of the Kingdom of Hawaii through these two very, very different families. And I love the story because it's a much bigger story. It's a story about manifest destiny. It's a story about America's place in the world at a very critical moment in its history, the first time it's expanded beyond its continental borders and took over a sovereign nation.
Hmm. I think another thing about this that is interesting is I think sometimes when we look back at history and we look at things that seem mostly to be very unfortunate, we sometimes forget that often those stories began, in a sense, very brightly, and things were done with, at least for the most part, the very best of intentions, at least as they were understood in that particular time and place, versus sometimes the more sort of blunt way with which such stories are told, with this sense of greed and corruption from the start. It seems like this particular story of Hawaii and what we might call its ultimate corruption by the West is not a story that can be told in such simplistic terms.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you. And that was one of the things that was so surprising to me when I began my research. The first Western contact with the Hawaiian Islanders, who, as you mentioned, had lived in isolation for hundreds and hundreds of years, was by Captain Cook, Captain James Cook, the great British explorer. And he had been searching for the Northwest Passage, and he encountered this archipelago of volcanic islands in 1778. And speaking to your point about good intentions, he instructed his men to really not engage in any sexual relations with the Hawaiians, knowing that there was a risk that they would bring disease. Well, unfortunately, despite those good intentions, that did not happen. And very rapidly, diseases from the West spread through the population of Hawaiians. And, you know, one of the figures that's so startling to me is the best estimates of how many native Hawaiians there were at the time of Western contact when Captain Cook arrived was somewhere between 300 and 400,000 people. By the time, you know, fast forward a century or so, the late 19th century, that population had dropped to a quarter of that size, to around 90,000 people. It's
wow.
Just a dramatic story of good intentions in some way gone awry. And likewise, soon, not a few decades after Captain Cook arrived, the Christian missionaries arrived, and they had, you know, a very brave group of people who had weathered a journey around Cape Horn from Boston to make it to what was then known as the Sandwich Islands. And they had come to bring the word of God to the Hawaiians, and they did some very remarkable things. They brought reading and writing to a people who up until that point had had oral culture, and they had raised the literacy rate of the Hawaiian people to a very remarkably high level by the 1840s. So they certainly came to do good, but the old cliche in Hawaii is about the missionaries is they came to do good, and they did very well indeed. So that first group had very good intentions, but then their descendants turned to business, and that's when things started going awry.
We're speaking with Julia Flynn Seiler about her book, Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, the Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. I absolutely love the way you begin the introduction to the book. The story of Hawaii begins millions of years ago, long before the green folds of its mountains were created by cataracts foaming into the sea. I mean, you tell the story of essentially what we know about how these islands were initially formed, and then tell us actually a remarkable amount about ancient Hawaii and the people who lived there and how they lived there. I'm curious, first of all, where our notion of ancient Hawaii comes from.
Well, to a large extent, our understanding, our sources on ancient Hawaii come from the very first white Western explorers. For example, Captain Cook had a scientist aboard his ship, and that scientist took extremely careful notes of what he found on the journeys. And one of the most remarkable parts of his diaries was Hawaiian culture. And so, for example, the intricate construction of aqueducts 20 feet high, well, that was somebody aboard Captain Cook's ship who told us about that. And the ancient Hawaiians, they didn't have printing presses. They didn't have a written language. And so while they had a remarkable sense of history passed down through chants and through oral means, they didn't leave much of a written record. And so that's why it's kind of a challenge for someone coming in to represent different sides of the story, both the Hawaiian side and the Western view. And we've had to rely to some extent on the Western view, but as there's more scholarship being done, for example, translating Hawaiian newspapers, we're starting to get more glimmers of the Hawaiian perspective.
Hmm. One thing you write in the introduction is quite intriguing. You say, perhaps because they lived with the unpredictability of the earth and the seas, the ancient Hawaiians adopted strict rules governing nearly every aspect of life. Tell us more about that, and also to what extent that approach to life, that approach to living, carried on into the modern era, and for that matter, even unto today.
Well, the Hawaiians brought their customs and their beliefs from the other Polynesian islands that they originally came from. Scientists think that probably Tahiti or the Marquesas, and they paddled these double-hulled canoes across the Pacific. So they arrived in Hawaii, and the Polynesian societies had very strictly regimented hierarchical societies with the chiefs known as the Ali'i at the top, or the Ali'i Nui, which are the high chiefs, and then below that, commoners, and then even a few slaves. And the society was such that the high chiefs had absolute power. For example, if a commoner were to cross the path of the high chief and cast a shadow on him, he could be put to death for that. And there were human sacrifices to the various gods. It was a multi-theistic society. And so some of the chants that are so powerful reflect the fear that certainly the commoners lived in at that time. And certainly the society changed so dramatically when Westerners came and brought guns and ammunition, because the Hawaiians had not had metal, they had not had armaments before. And the great chief Kamehameha met Captain Cook and was keenly interested in the weapons that he had on board, and within a few years had traded for weapons and started waging a bloody war against the other chiefs of the islands, and eventually united the eight populated islands of Hawaii by the beginning of the 19th century.
I had heard the name Captain Cook. I think probably most Americans have, but I really didn't know much of anything about his encounter with the Hawaiian Islands, which began in January of 1778 and ended in very bloody fashion for Captain Cook just over a year later. But in a sense, this is a really interesting example of what I was saying towards the top of the interview, of how part of the story of the Hawaiian Islands and of the Hawaiians' encounter with the West is about a story that begins with such promise, in a sense, or at least on the surface, and ends so badly. And in the case of Captain Cook and his visit to Hawaii, he seems to be actually amazed at how warmly he is welcomed and how beautifully all of this seems to go at the onset. Tell us how, in fact, this ultimately ended so badly for Captain Cook.
Yes, well, as you pointed out, he was warmly embraced by the Hawaiians. They thought he was the returning god Lono, and so they showered he and his men with food and with hospitality. The ships leave after a period of time and then come back, and I think partly the Hawaiians realized that, well, the god Lono wouldn't have been returning, and so perhaps that cast a pall on their original misconception of hope of Captain Cook as a god. But his eventual death was such a terrible thing, because it was over a matter that was so petty, really. There had been a misunderstanding. A Hawaiian had stolen a canoe from one of Captain Cook's boats, and he sent several men to try to get it back. And eventually Captain Cook himself went on to shore to try to settle the dispute. And emotions rose, and he was stabbed in the back and ended up falling face first into the water, into lava, the lava fields. And he died that way. And it was a very ignominious end to a splendid career as an explorer. And Hawaiians, though, did respect Captain Cook as a chief. They maybe not a god anymore, but a chief, and they took his body and they prepared his body in a way that they would have prepared the body of one of their own chiefs, and they scored his flesh and they salted it, and then they eventually returned parts of his body to the ships, which I can only imagine horrified the remaining sailors, and they fairly rapidly returned to England.
You suggest at the end of the book's introduction that although they returned back to Britain, that is the surviving sailors, with sort of this horrific tale of Captain Cook's death and how some of his remains were delivered to them, that also they told stories of these islands that surely attracted the attention and great interest of many of their countrymen. I mean, that is part of what set many of the following events in motion quite directly.
Yes, all of a sudden word of a tropical paradise bursting with fruit and beautiful, beautiful people made their way into the English-speaking world. And at that point in time, you know, the great power was Britain, British Empire. And America was growing by leaps and bounds, acquiring territories. It pushed west. And all of a sudden, countries started looking more intently at Asia. And the Hawaiian Islands were strategically located halfway between the west continental coast of North America and China and Japan. And so as trading ships passed through, they would reprovision in Honolulu Harbor. And likewise, the whalers would stop and reprovision there. And Honolulu itself became this rollicking port town with a red light district and all kinds of crazy people and interesting characters kind of being washed ashore. One of my favorite stories is about Herman Melville, who was working on a whaler. And he took a few months off and worked in downtown Honolulu as a pin setter in a bowling alley in the 1840s. And likewise, Mark Twain in the 1860s, early on in his career, was sent out by the Sacramento Union newspaper to report back on the commercial prospects of these islands and, you know, what opportunities were there for Americans. And sure enough, he sent back dispatches about the somewhat exaggerated, I must add, true to his character, about the prospects for growing sugar in the Hawaiian Islands, and he painted a portrait of a place that was just ripe for the picking, basically.
In more ways than one.
yes.
As you start chapter one, which tells about what would seem to be the first significant visit by Western Christian missionaries to Hawaii, that initial visit in, I think, 1820 comes just after a very interesting moment in Hawaiian history when you tell us an ancient law which forbade men and women to sit together as they ate was broken by the ruler of Hawaii at that time. It's an intriguing instance of where Hawaii seems, for whatever reason, to be sort of looking to the future with a new sense of openness, just as Westerners are about to land again on its shores. In a sense, the timing is so intriguing.
It is. It's an incredible coincidence. So the Hawaiians had really tossed out the totems, tossed out the old gods, and there was a void that the Christian missionaries swooped into and introduced the Christian God. And sure enough, many of the alii, many of the chiefs, embraced this new world view and sought out the missionaries and asked them to teach them to read and write. And there was an introduction of a written Hawaiian language for the first time. But why that happened at exactly the same time is a mystery and one of the strange coincidences in this story.
Hmm. I love this moment in this first chapter, and you're talking at this point about how there was what you describe at one point as Christian fervor sweeping over these Hawaiian islands. I mean, the natives there, at least by and large, very excited by the possibilities that this visit represented. And you write, as the ships disgorged hundreds of sailors onto the streets of the town, the languid port would roar to life with merchants hawking their wares and large groups of horseback riders kicking up dust. Merchants' tills clattered with English guineas, French double louis, American eagles, Spanish doubloons, and even Russian ducats. The sailors' appetites drew them not only to taverns and shops, but also to a special red-light district near the harbor named Cape Horn. Just one of a number of ways in which sailors found pleasure. I mean, this is happening right on the heels of this gentle entry of Christian missionaries into the arena. It's fascinating how quickly the story and its flavor, in a sense, can turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can only imagine the Christian missionaries wearing black in the tropical heat of dusty Honolulu, you know, trudging through the streets. And one of the stories I so loved was the story about the construction of the great church in downtown Honolulu, the first big Christian church to be erected. And it was built out of coral stone that Hawaiian laborers dragged from the ocean inland to build. You can see this church today. It's quite a remarkable structure. And it's still, every Sunday they have what they call Ali'i Sunday, which they pay tribute to the great chiefs of the kingdom days.
Hmm. You also give us an account of what was really an intensely disconcerting moment for the Hawaiians, which occurs in 1843 in what was ultimately regarded as a terrible diplomatic blunder on the part of the British, a grab for power that ultimately was reversed by the British a few months later. But it certainly was kind of a portent of what was to come. Tell our listeners about this interesting moment.
Yes, another strange, odd power grab by really relatively few Westerners. In this case, a handful of British arrivals in the islands, and they grabbed power from the monarch at the time. And held it for about 4 months until the Admiralty of the British Navy reversed it. And there were ceremonies, and the British flag was taken down again, and the Hawaiian flag was raised. And it's a very important episode. It didn't last very long, but it was very important because the children in the chief school, including Liliʻu Kalani, who is one of the key characters of Lost Kingdom.
The last queen of your title.
Yes, the last queen of the title. She witnessed this. She was a very, very young girl at this time. But it was an episode that indicated that the great powers of the day could be reasoned with and that law would prevail. And at this point in time, the Hawaiian Kingdom is a constitutional monarchy that has been modeled after Great Britain's. And there is a sophisticated judiciary. There is a parliament. There is the rule of law. And so certainly the chief's children were brought up to believe in the rule of law and that ultimately wrongs would be righted. And so that's what the chief's children saw when this strange episode with the British happened.
In a sense, I think what you're suggesting is that might have, in a sense, helped them frame certain events that came many years later in a certain sort of way and maybe led them to expect a certain kind of justice to be delivered again. In a sense, it left them vulnerable to maybe a naive view of the West and its ultimate intentions.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. Very well put.
We're speaking with Julia Flynn Seiler about her book Lost Kingdom, which charts for us, in a sense, the history of Hawaii in its encounters with the West, primarily through the 19th century. At one point, I think you put it so well, in saying that Hawaii was the reluctant bride in a contest with three suitors, America, Great Britain, and France. Ahead of us, taking the story from here, can you just give us kind of a general overview of that courtship, if we want to call it that, and the nature of it in terms of these three countries of the West?
Yes, this is taking place in the context of 19th century imperialism. Now, the greatest imperial power in the world, of course, was Great Britain, ruled by Queen Victoria. And to my surprise, I spent 4 years in the archives, and I did a lot of research for this book. And to my surprise, the ali'i, the chiefs, and particularly Liliʻu Kalani, the last queen, was very much an Anglophile. She looked to Queen Victoria as a model of what a ruler should be. And, of course, there's a vast difference between the tiny fly specks of the Hawaiian Islands and the great British Empire. But nonetheless, Liliʻu Kalani had been invited by Queen Victoria to travel to England and to help her celebrate her royal jubilee. And when she was in England, she certainly got a sense of the power and the might of constitutional monarchies, such as her own was modeled after. And while she was there, she ordered uniforms for liveried footmen. So when I came across a photograph in the archives of Liliʻu Kalani, instead of wearing what I had imagined she might have been wearing, a loosely fitting gown, she was in fact wearing a tightly corseted gown with a diamond tiara and four footmen in the white knee stockings that had come from England. So it was very startling. So the Hawaiians felt great affinity for Great Britain. Nonetheless, there were also the French. The French were very interested in expanding their holdings in Polynesia and succeeded in doing so in places such as Tahiti. The Germans were also interested, and they grabbed places such as Samoa. And, of course, America was directly in the path. Hawaii was directly in the path for America on the way to Asia. And there were many Americans in Hawaii starting in the middle of the 19th century who were avidly interested in adding Hawaii to the United States.
Hmm. In the second chapter of the book, when you are talking, I think, primarily about the influence of the British on Hawaii between the years 1843 and 1861, you talk about Hawaii encountering certain new breakthroughs and technology and ideas. And one of the most profound, you say, and one of the developments with very far-reaching consequences is that of land reform. What are we talking about here? In what way was the concept of land and land reform so significant for the people of Hawaii?
Well, prior to Western contact, the land was held by the alii, by the chiefs, essentially in trust for the Hawaiian people. And the chiefs would parcel out kind of wedge-shaped portions of the land that ran from the mountains all the way to the seashore. And so families or groups would have access to a variety of different types of resources. They had fishing grounds, places to grow taro, and also freshwater streams coming down from the mountains. Well, in 1840, something occurred called the Mehele, which was the Great Land Divide, and that was instituted by Western advisors to the monarchs. And the idea was to permit private land ownership and the purchase of private land ownership, including the purchase of land by Westerners. Now, there was a provision for the commoners, the Hawaiian, native Hawaiian commoners, to be able to purchase land, but it involved having to file paperwork and so forth and so on. Well, that, not surprisingly, didn't happen. And very rapidly what happened was that Westerners started accumulating land and purchasing land primarily from the chiefs themselves. And it led to quite a concentration of land in the hands of foreigners, essentially.
I want to ask you about some of the interesting leaders of Hawaii through this period, beginning with an intriguing figure who ends up marrying someone from Britain by the name of Emma, who ultimately becomes Queen Emma to the people of Hawaii. Tell us about this particular leader of Hawaii, Liholiho, is that how you pronounce that name?
Yes, that's how you pronounce it.
And this wedding in 1856, which in some respects is such an intriguing embodiment of this clash of traditional Hawaii with these encroaching Western ways.
Yes, yes. Well, Liholiho was a descendant of Kamehameha. He was a member of the Kamehameha dynasty. And he married his sweetheart, Emma. And Emma was part British, part Hawaiian. She was a princess at the time. And they had a marvelously traditional British wedding in Hawaii. In fact, it was officiated by a member of the Anglican Church, which the two of them belonged to. And so very much the ruling classes of Hawaii were, you know, really, really modeled themselves after the British. And this was a very sad story. They had a child together, but Liholiho very rapidly died. Emma made a bid to become the queen, the ruling sovereign. And under the system of government then, the rulers were elected by members of parliament. And she lost out to a very different type of person, a man named David Kalakaua. And David Kalakaua was not a direct descendant of Kamehameha. In fact, he was backed by American interests, and Emma was backed more by British interests. And when David ended up being elected rather than Emma, it caused a riot, quite a violent outpouring. And so from the very beginning, what I call the House of Kalakaua, the last ruling dynasty of the Hawaiian kingdom, really came to power in huge animosity. And kind of embodied the struggle between these two rival superpowers, the British and the American.
Right. So it's an ominous beginning, and
very ominous.
Yeah. And even just ahead of that, I find it intriguing that there is more than one early death when we talk about the succession of monarchs in this period. I mean, of a man who will accede to the throne and then die actually quite quickly and young of natural causes. And I wonder if you sense this as being a significant factor in Hawaii's ultimate vulnerability. I mean, the fact that there was, in a sense, this rapid turnover for a time and for at a crucial moment, not a strong, long-lived ruler to carry Hawaii forward in its own right, in a sense.
Yes, it was a heartbreaking string of deaths amongst not only the ruling class of Hawaii, but commoners. Just such a devastating vulnerability to Western diseases and epidemics of smallpox and other problems swept through the islands repeatedly and really affect the native Hawaiians almost more than any other group. And so when the election came between Emma and David Kalakaua, no one probably ever imagined that David Kalakaua would have been in line for the throne. He was not a direct descendant of Kamehameha, and it was really a result of this parade of death that has happened, leaving him and his sisters as some of the only alii still standing and able to take on this responsibility.
This Kalakaua ends up visiting the United States, and in the wake of that visit to the United States, signs some kind of treaty. Tell us about this moment and how crucial it is in this chain of events.
Yes, this was called the Reciprocity Treaty. And just roll back time just a little bit. From volcanic islands that really had very little monoculture on them, in just a period of decades, the islands were transformed, and the sugar planters, who for the most part were Western businessmen, gained a lot of power in the kingdom, a lot of say in the kingdom, and they were King Kalakaua's advisors. And they not only controlled sugar plantations, but the banks, the steamship lines, the power companies, much of the infrastructure of the islands. And it was very important to this group of businessmen to be able to sell their sugar onto the mainland of North America on good trade grounds. And so they pushed very aggressively for what was called the Reciprocity Treaty. And in exchange for allowing the United States access to the deep water, what could have been the deep water port at Pearl Harbor, American sugar planters got to send their sugar to the United States on very favorable grounds. But there was, even then, there was some concern on the part of Native Hawaiians and others that by giving up Pearl Harbor, by giving up access to this area, that would be the first step in the kingdom losing its independence. And, of course, those critics, those people who raised the alarm were right about that.
Hmm. It is in the wake of this treaty being signed that a very crucial American by the name of Klaus Spreckelt enters the fray. What does he represent in this larger story?
Well, Klaus Spreckelt was really a marvelous Gilded Age character, kind of larger than life. He was a German-American. He was cigar-chomping. He had begun his life in Germany, immigrated to the United States, went to California and quickly developed kind of a beet sugar empire in the Golden State. And once he heard about the prospects for sugar in Hawaii, he rapidly made his way over there and quickly acquired a big swath of land on the island of Maui from one of the Ali'i, Princess Ruth. And he became very close to David Kalakaua. In fact, for a period of time, he was kind of David Kalakaua's shadow advisor. And he and the king and other Western advisors would have parties and play cards at the king's boathouse in Honolulu Harbor and get up to all kinds of mischief. And Klaus Spreckels spent a lot of time in Honolulu. You know, he would leave his kind of cold, foggy mansion in San Francisco and take one of the steamers across the Pacific and land in tropical Honolulu, where he had a house. And for a while, he really was the Sugar King, and that was his nickname, and was very welcomed by the royal family. But he also became a moneylender to the last king, to David Kalakaua. And he indebted David and gained so much control over the kingdom that others started to accuse Klaus Spreckels of corruption and of bribery. And ultimately, Klaus Spreckels had death threats against him and all kinds of other things, whilst he still remained loyal to the royal family.
Hmm. You tell us that Kalakaua ended up suffering mounting debts, the result of rampant overspending. And one of the things you suggest is that, among other things, it laid, in effect, a very unstable foundation for when Liliu would reign as queen. This was, in a sense, a hole from which Hawaii and its leaders just simply could not escape. Can you tell us more about the nature of this and its lasting consequences?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that fascinated me about this story were the sibling dynamics. I mean, you really couldn't find two more different people than David Kalakaua and Liliu. David Kalakaua had the nickname the Merry Monarch, and he loved parties, and he was a man of very wide girth. He was a big man, a beautiful singing voice. And he, on the one hand, had a very expansive vision of Hawaii's place in the world. He was the first king to circumnavigate the globe, and he visited Asian kingdoms and Europe and came back with lots of great ideas, including he had visited Thomas Edison and had a demonstration of the light bulb. And so during Kalakaua's reign, he built Iolani Palace, which is still, as I mentioned, in downtown Honolulu, and was a beautiful small palace, and it had electric lights 4 years before the White House in Washington, D.C. But in the building of that palace, he accrued debts. He overspent. And in the meantime, Liliu Kalani, as I mentioned, like her brother, they were both educated by missionaries, but Liliu was really more of a Victorian church lady. She ran the church choir for decades. She wrote hymns. She did social work and did charitable works and was very involved in teaching girls. And Liliu watched the mounting debts of her brother with a great deal of concern. And sure enough, when her brother died in 1891 at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco, Liliu inherited the throne, but inherited the throne and inherited the kingdom at a critical time. The kingdom's finances were a mess. It was in the midst of, there was a general economic depression, not only in Hawaii, but also in the United States, that hurt the sugar planters and caused them a great deal of concern. And so she had a very, very difficult hand of cards dealt to her by her brother and by the overall state of the world.
Mm. Among the dramatic events that overtake Liliu is ultimately her arrest and house imprisonment. How did those events engulf her?
Well, Liliu Kalani was overthrown in 1893 in essentially a bloodless coup led by white, mostly people from the business class. And it happened just in a period of days, extremely rapidly, and she ended up having to leave the palace, and the new government, headed by Sanford Dole, moved into the palace. So 2 years later, a group of her supporters, Native Hawaiians, some white sympathizers, even members of the Spreckles family, we believe, helped supply arms and helped to mount a counterinsurgency. They were trying to mount a counter coup to take back the kingdom and reinstall her in the throne. Well, Liliu was not directly involved in this, but the provisional government at the time, or the government at the time, accused her of knowing about the plot to overthrow them. And so she was arrested, and she was locked up in a bedroom suite on the first floor of the Iolani Palace, and she spent 8 months there under house arrest. And one of the moments in the course of my researching Lost Kingdom that was so meaningful, so powerful to me, was being in the archives of the Bishop Museum in Honolulu. And I came across a page that Liliu had torn from the Book of Psalms. And she had written in pencil on top of this page, Iolani Palace, January 16th, 1895, am imprisoned in this room by the government of the Hawaiian Republic for the attempt of the Hawaiian people to regain what had been wrested from them by the children of the missionaries who first brought the word of God to my people. And finding that yellow page, which she'd presumably torn out of the Bible and written on during the first night of her imprisonment, just gave me goosebumps. You know, in Hawaii they call it giving you chicken skin. Hmm. And that's what I felt holding that piece of paper.
That had to bring that moment alive to you, and it brings it alive to us. And also, of course, so much of this expansive, complex story is tied up, kind of what we were talking about at the beginning, of something that at many points along the way was ultimately a beautiful story, but which ultimately ends with such tragedy for the Hawaiian people, at least in many respects.
I like to also think, I agree, it's such a tragic story, but for me, thinking deeply about this story and living with it for so many years, there are very beautiful moments, too, in it. And, for example, Liliu found it in her heart at the end of her life to forgive her enemies and to forgive being imprisoned and to forgive being, really, there was a very malicious propaganda campaign waged against her in which people called her a barbarian and much worse than that. And I found it inspiring that she could look back on that history of loss and death and injustice and find it in her heart to forgive. And that said, too, you know, as I wrote this book, I listened to a lot of Hawaiian music, and including some of the songs that the Queen composed, probably most famously Aloha Oe, which is probably the most famous Hawaiian song to this day. And I felt very lucky to have gotten to understand the beauty of the culture in the course of researching this book. Mm. And my hope is Lost Kingdom will help other people see the beauty, see the epic quality of the story, and help us appreciate our 50th state a little bit more.
Hmm. The book is Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, King, the Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Julia Flynn Seiler, thank you so much for this marvelous book and for this opportunity for me to speak with you about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, yet another interview out of The Morning Show archives. And we remind you that if you're interested in hearing any past Morning Shows, you should go to our